We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producer for our program is Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. And in this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Robert J. Lifton. He is a scholar, a psychiatrist, someone who is known around the world for writing about the psychological causes and effects of war. In his work, he has written on many subjects. He's profiled survivors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and also has explored the seductive power of nuclear weapons. He has written about thought control, about terrorism. He's written about the Holocaust. He is the author of a number of books, among them The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. He's written about the experience of surviving Hiroshima in his book Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima. He's also written about the experiences of Vietnam veterans after coming home. And he is the author of now a recently published memoir about his life and his many interests, and the title of his book is Witness to an Extreme Century, and it's published by the Free Press. It's out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Our guest, Robert Lifton, is lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is also a distinguished professor emeritus at City University of New York. We're pleased to have him with us, and questions and comments are welcome. And again, we hope that people, if they want to join the conversation, they're welcome, but it would help us if they can be brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And it is also possible to send us an email. It is will-talk at illinois.edu. And Dr. Lifton, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us again.
Happy to be with you.
We certainly appreciate it. One of the things that you write about in the book is the fact that when you were younger, certainly before you thought about being a physician, you were very interested in history. And, of course, later on went to put these two things together, your interest in history and your study of psychiatry. What was it, do you think, when you were a boy, what was it about history that you found so engaging?
It's hard to know exactly what I found engaging, but there was something about larger human behavior, collective human behavior, that appealed to me. And I do remember writing reports about historical events and getting deeply involved and always having opinions about the ethical issues. And I sometimes say, Freud said that psychoanalysis and all of his life work was his path to his basic interest, which was that of ancient cultures. So in some way, if I'm so bold as to draw an analogy, I could say that my work in different parts of the world, which has been psychological, is my path to my original interest in history. It seems to work that way. And my interest in history has been sustained and undoubtedly deepened over the course of my life, as I find that this larger historical perspective is absolutely necessary to understand psychologically the groups of people I interviewed or studied.
Mm-hmm. Because the kind of people that you studied have been people who have been caught up in large, sweeping, overwhelming historical events?
Absolutely. And I mentioned that Erik Erikson was a powerful influence on me because he, in his work, suggested applying psychoanalytic ideas to history. He developed a model that could be called the great man or great person in history. And so he He produced his great psychobiographies on Luther and Gandhi from that model. And I was enormously influenced by him, but altered the model to be that of a group of individual people who were either acted upon by history in an important way, or who themselves acted upon history or some combination thereof. And in that way, I called it shared themes for such people. And that's the model I came to use, whether it was interviewing people coming out of China in Hong Kong, or survivors of Hiroshima, or Nazi doctors, or others, Vietnam veterans, or others whom I studied.
Mm-hmm. You explain in the book that you ended up going to Asia, East Asia. At the time of the Korean War, you were drafted, as many doctors were, that were drafted and sent there, and that you were there and worked as a psychiatrist, and that a couple of things happened that seemed to really have set you on the course that you would follow to the present. In part, one of those things, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, was your opportunity to talk with POWs, American POWs, who had been held by the Chinese. But
yeah.
The other thing maybe I'd want to come to first is the fact that you had this opportunity to talk with people who had been survivors of the bombing of Hiroshima. And it sounds as if that was something that changed you in a very personally in a very fundamental way, and helped that, as I said, really helped set you on the course that you're still on.
Yes. Just in terms of the first point that you made, I went out to the Far East in the military. I was in the doctor draft, and I wasn't happy about going into the military. But as it turned out, the military really profoundly influenced my life by enabling me to discover the world when they sent me to Tokyo and then to South Korea and then back to Japan, where I was fascinated by that country and by the currents in the Far East at that time. My work in Hiroshima was my second study, and it was it had a very strong impact on me because, as I say in my memoir, it's one thing to talk to people, as I did, about what happened in Hiroshima. It's another thing to interview in psychological depth over hours particular people who had been exposed to the bomb and underwent the most grotesque and painful and moving and disturbing kinds of life experiences. And that gave me a visceral sense of what nuclear weapons can do. And it certainly changed my worldview forever, so that Hiroshima became a lens or a prism through which I've seen the world ever since. And yes, I've become interested in the broader psychology of the impact of nuclear weapons on our own country and throughout the world. And that's been a major issue for me and continues to be.
It seems that the people that you talked to that were survivors there of Hiroshima certainly had this feeling that experience had changed them at a very deep level, that it was something that I'm sure it was difficult for other people to understand that. But what's really striking is that it seems that in some way they felt that it was almost like an infection in the sense that it was something that could be passed on.
Yes, because the atomic bomb was unique in not only its extraordinary scope of destructiveness and those the large number of people it killed instantly in the explosion and in the fires that resulted and the heat, but also in the element of radiation, which really was a lifelong immersion in death, as I put it, so that those exposed for an instant in time could undergo fear of acute radiation effects, the dreaded purple spots which people got and many died in relation to, and then over time, over the course of their lifetime, the danger and fear of delayed radiation effects in the form of leukemias and then cancers And then the idea that it could be transmitted, the danger effects could be transmitted to subsequent generations. So that was a permanent exposure to this taint of radiation. To some extent, survivors of any catastrophe can feel wounded and in some way rejected by others. But in the case of Hiroshima survivors, there was the actual danger of radiation effects, which did give survivors a sense of taint. They struggled sometimes heroically and impressively to overcome that and recover, and most did, but they never fully got rid of this sense of being exposed to a taint that went on forever.
And for you, the way that it touched you, one way that it touched you was this feeling that you were witnessing a possible future here, and one that humanity ought to do everything that it could possibly do to avoid?
Yes. Well, I was not an actual survivor. I wasn't in Hiroshima when the bomb was dropped. Mm-hmm. I got there 17 years after the bomb. But any sensitive person couldn't help feeling deep compassion for these people and an identification with them and their ordeal that they went through. And that identification with survivors was the beginning of my sense of witness. It was a kind of professional witness because I had to be able to step back to some extent and take in what they told me and begin to try to understand what it meant psychologically and historically. But I was never detached from it in the sense of unmoved by it. And I felt that once I had had that experience, I had the responsibility for witness, and not just witness, not just telling a story, but taking a stand against the source of that kind of pain, against nuclear weapons in general.
Mm-hmm. You know, yesterday on the program, I had the chance to spend some time talking with Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's an oncologist and has written a very good book, and a testament to how good it is was it got the Pulitzer Prize. That's a history of cancer, and his book is called The Emperor of All Maladies. And he said something that I thought was very striking, is something about the relationship between doctors and patients. And he said that essentially what it was about, going back a long way and still at a very basic level, it was about telling stories. He said that first when a physician sits down with a patient, the doctor says to the patient, well, tell me your story. Tell me what's going on with you. And then the doctor listens and then tells a story back. And that this relationship, this doctor-patient relationship, is very much about telling stories.
Yes.
It's striking to me that really is something that you always have tried to do.
Absolutely. I started out my memoir by saying I've spent much of my life listening, mm-hmm. And it's listening to stories. Every group that I chose the interview method because that seemed the most human and the most revelatory method for any grasp of what people had been subjected to. But what I was listening for were their stories, their narratives, as they told what had happened to them if they had been exposed to the bomb, or if they had been a Nazi doctor or a survivor of Auschwitz, or whomever I was talking to told me those stories, and I became very sensitive to narratives. And I agree with Mukherjee and what he said. And the good doctors are those who really listen to stories and encourage stories rather than going too quickly to their technology without hearing a full narrative. And so I listen to stories and I try to retell the stories that I listen to or sum them up in my retelling. And in the process, I was living out my own story. Certainly, my memoir is about my own narrative in the experience of listening to the stories of different people that I encountered and then retelling them and then speaking about my own experience in relation to their story. So everywhere there's a story, there's a narrative. And I might add that when you write a memoir, you, in a sense, give a certain coherence to your life that you didn't exactly experience while you've been living it. The coherence is real. You're taking another look at what you've been doing over those decades and what the threads of continuity have been. And all that is a story. It's the larger story of your own personal experience in my case, listening to the stories of others.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Robert J. Lifton. He is a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, distinguished professor emeritus at City University of New York, and has written about many subjects, has been interested in many different things. As we've mentioned, he's written about the Holocaust and written about physicians who worked with the Nazi regime. He has written about thought control based on some of his experiences working with American POWs who were held by the Chinese during the Korean War. He's written about the experience of men who fought in Vietnam, about people who survived Hiroshima, many, many different things. And he is the author of a recently published memoir that tries to explain some of his life and some of his experiences and where these interests come from. The title of the book is Witness to an Extreme Century, and it's published by Free Press. And questions, comments are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. And we do have someone here to bring into the conversation in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Thanks, David. I hope I'm not being redundant, but your guest, I am wondering first if three things. If he studied as a psychiatrist the work of Wilhelm Reich and the social studies, primitive social studies of Lewis Henry Morgan, and if he has had any thoughts about the Homo sapien practice of killing each other, and if any other species that he's read about or knows about, I would like to hear about that. So I'll just ring off and listen. Thank you.
Well, you know, I've read some of Wilhelm Reich, but he hasn't been a major influence on me. As I mentioned, the major psychoanalytic influence on me has been Erik Erikson, who, in my view, took psychoanalysis into history. But, of course, everything goes back to Freud, and I talk about a struggle with orthodoxy that I had, and that was a very important matter in those early days in the 50s and 60s, where psychoanalysis still held reign over much of American psychiatry. All that has changed, and psychoanalysis has mellowed to some extent, but there was that issue of orthodoxy and my own paradox in that I understood psychoanalysis to be one of the great intellectual movements of the modern era, and at the same time, it had become itself quite dogmatic and closed and could be an interference if one held to it narrowly. That was a paradox with which I struggled through my earlier work.
Mm-hmm. The second part of the, or perhaps the third part of the question, would be natural, and I'm sure that you're asked about this all the time, given that you have written about so many dark chapters of history, and you know, one can infer from the title of the memoir that you spend some time reflecting on that. That people want to ask you, well, based on what you have done, you reflect on human nature. Would you say that human beings are basically dark, violent, bad, or can you find some reason to say, well, it's not a completely bad picture?
I'm essentially a hopeful person, and carrying out these studies in each case has been an act of hope. That doesn't mean that I'm wildly optimistic. Hope always means possibility. When I finished particularly my work on Nazi doctors, which perhaps was the furthest descent into evil, friends of mine would say to me, well, okay, you've done that study. Now what do you think of human beings? And they expected me to say, not very much. But my answer is that we as human beings can go either way. We're not absolutely wired to be violent and destructive, nor are we absolutely wired to be constructive and life-affirming. We have in our wiring, in what we call human nature, the possibility for either direction. And that's where culture and history and collective as well as individual behavior and psychology all come in. And that's the area in which I work. So I would repeat, I also saw in these dark events examples of resiliency and of moving capacity for strength and ethical concern through that haze of darkness. So with that all, I continue to be a hopeful person, though emphasizing how important it is for all of us to confront some of the most dreadful things that human beings are capable of doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, thinking about, I guess one of the things that I find fascinating about Freud, and you know, one would allow that there has been criticism of his methods and his conclusions, but I think one of the things I find fascinating about him is the idea that he didn't have the kind of appreciation of the neurophysiology of the brain that we have now. He couldn't give somebody a CAT scan. What he was really relying on was storytelling and metaphor and trying to encourage people to, in whatever way that they possibly could, to tell him a story about what their inner experience was. And then he would go from that to try to craft his own story that would make sense. And it just strikes me as that's something that probably within the field of within psychology doesn't happen very much anymore. You know, maybe that's of limited utility, but it seems that as a window into what human experience is all about, that can be useful.
Absolutely. It's still profoundly important psychologically and psychohistorically, as we say, to listen to stories, to understand stories. And Freud's telling of stories about his patients, as he did in his original work, in his early work, that was a breakthrough at the time. Doctors then weren't in the habit of doing scientific work or what they considered scientific work by listening to stories or telling stories. And Freud, who always wanted to consider himself a scientist, began to feel that one had to evoke those stories to understand or evolve a science of the mind. So Freud, you know, could be dogmatic, as could his followers. But that encouragement of storytelling, of narrative in his patients was a fundamental breakthrough in what he did. And it also has to be said that he inherited the language of physiology and what you might call energy or energic language, and yet he translated it, you know, the terms catharsis and... yet he... transformed that into a psychology. That was quite an amazing feat and part of his genius.
Let us take another caller, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted you to talk about two projects I think you're involved with. I know about the Hiroshima, but I'd like for you to comment on the suppression of the video. I also knew an African-American soldier who was one of the people that went into blast areas immediately afterwards, and I'm wondering whether you ever set about in your research to track them down and talk to them. The other thing is, I think I heard an interview with you associating yourself with the need for U.S. reparations for Agent Orange. Maybe that's a figment, but it seems you probably have some thoughts about that anyway. And as you've gone there a fair amount, you probably know some of the details that most people want to avert their eyes from. And so I'm fasting for a blood test, so I'm kind of lightheaded, so I think I'll listen on the phone.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
Well, you've raised a number of questions. First, the record of the American occupation in Japan is not very good in relation to nuclear weapons. Maybe one can say that it's the occupation served some decent functions in its focus on democratization, but it also suppressed information actively about the atomic bombings, and it suppressed photographic information. My friend and sometimes co-author Greg Mitchell has written a new book about rediscovered photographs, which the occupation had tried to keep from people's awareness. Because America sensed that there was something different and perhaps wrong about the use of the atomic bomb, even though this has never been admitted officially, but had this view sufficiently to suppress details about it. We've had a hard time subsequently. Now there's no longer that kind of suppression, but we've had a hard time subsequently dealing with Hiroshima. There's also something else that I did encounter in Hiroshima. I didn't talk to American survivors of Hiroshima who happened to be there, but I was in contact with the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, which was a dubious group in Hiroshima in that it was conducting interviews with Hiroshima survivors to study radiation effects, but refused to offer any therapy. And later, some in-house documents of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission were discovered by a researcher who wrote a book about it, and they revealed quite clearly that the reason why they offered no treatment was that that would be a form of redemption or of admitting that there was something specially wrong about the use of the atomic bomb, which an official American agency didn't want to do. So all that is part of our record in relation to Japan. I think now it's incumbent on all of us to not only open up all knowledge about atomic bombings, because this is really a problem of humankind. It's not a problem for the Japanese or the Americans alone, but also to make known what newer weapons and what larger nuclear threats really assault us. And then finally, the point I would make about all this is Japan is now going through a dreadful sequence of events, part of them in relation to nuclear threat from nuclear power at Fukushima. And I wrote a short editorial piece in International Herald Tribune called Hiroshima and Fukushima, or Fukushima and Hiroshima, pointing out the simple fact that it's the same stuff. And those who have foisted nuclear power on the world have kind of pretended or tried to convince people that it was completely safe, and even that it was somehow different in its technology from the weaponry. But that's not true. It's the same stuff as the weaponry, as the Japanese are now rightly insisting, and we should take note of as well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Robert J. Lifton, and we'll talk some more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, our food week continues with the story of bananas, why they often don't taste like they used to, and why their future is endangered. We'll hear from Dan Capel, author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Also, New Yorker science writer Michael Spector on the possibility of creating hamburgers in test tubes. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics for you. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about prostate cancer with Philippa Cheatham, a board-certified urological surgeon at Columbia University Medical Center. Then hour two, our guest is William Adler, who's written a new biography of Joe Hill. Joe Hill was a labor leader in 1914. He was convicted of murder in Utah, and he was executed. Many people feel that he was innocent. The book that we'll be talking about tomorrow, The Man Who Never Died, is a result of a lot of research that the guest did, William Adler, and it is his conclusion that, in fact, Joe Hill was not guilty of that crime with which he was charged. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon and 10 different topics, and we always welcome your calls. You can check out our schedule by going to the website, WILL.illinois.edu. Our guest for this hour, Robert J. Lifton, is a scholar, psychiatrist. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. He's a distinguished professor emeritus at City University of New York. And as we have mentioned, he has written on many subjects, on thought reform, on Nazi doctors. He has profiled some individuals who were survivors of the bombing of Hiroshima. He's written about the experiences of Vietnam veterans, and he has a new book out that's a memoir that's titled Witness to an Extreme Century, and it's published by Free Press. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We're coming up to the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, and right after 9/11, we went out looking for people that we could talk to on our programs here and on the Afternoon Magazine to try to help us understand what had happened, and what this meant. And you were one of the people that we called, and you were generous enough to talk with us. And that's why one of the reasons we thought we would like to talk with you today, to get some thought, your perspective on now 10 years later, on the meaning of this event.
Has considerable resonance. 10 years is a round number. It's a significant figure. And one way of looking at it is that with the 10th year anniversary, 9/11 becomes a historical form of survival. It's a piece of history. Of course, it still remains a vivid, visceral experience for those who were directly exposed to it. But I've been thinking about it with some friends of mine, and we have wondered about the possibility of the meanings that are given to 9/11. I talk in my work in general about the meanings that survivors must give to their death encounter, because no death encounter, whether it's 9/11 or Hiroshima or Nazi genocide, no death encounter has an inherent meaning. In itself, survivors give it meaning, and so do the rest of us as more distant or historical survivors. And there would be something valuable taking place if we found ourselves able, in combining the experience of direct survivors of 9/11 with those of people affected by it, the rest of Americans, one might say, and many throughout the world, if the meaning given to 9/11 could increasingly be that of overcoming the forces that led to it. Mm. Not simply the war on terror, as George W. Bush put it, in which he wanted to wipe out all terrorists militarily and eliminate all evil, as he put it, but rather the forces of violence and counterviolence in the world, back and forth in many cases, involving ourselves and involving Islamist terrorists, as a meaning of 9/11 in the direction of overcoming those forces toward nonviolent resolution of these historical conflicts.
Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, thinking back, there was a sense that even though maybe few of us were directly affected, that it was something that we were all a part of. There was also this idea, I think many people said, that it was an event that would forever change the world and change life. And it seemed that fairly quickly normal life resumed, so that one wonders now, all these, you know, these 10 years later, whether there was any, whether there were ways in which it fundamentally changed this country.
I think it had a lasting effect on the American psyche. That is, the extreme vulnerability that was demonstrated, that we shared with everyone. I think that, I've written a short book I've called Superpower Syndrome. And superpower syndrome, by that I mean a sense of omnipotence and omnipotent power and invulnerability, which of course is illusory, because everyone, every collective group, every nation, every national group is vulnerable. That's the nature of human existence. But that was painfully demonstrated to us by 9/11, and where we go from there is what I'm talking about in connection with survivor meaning. And I think that has been a lasting effect on Americans, though it's also true that there have been acts of terror in elsewhere in the world. We are not the only ones subjected to this, and perhaps we've begun to learn something about terror, even to the effect of President Obama saying he's ending the concept of the war on terror, perhaps grasping the fact that the war on terror, being without limits and being militarily gauged, was itself a bit apocalyptic and inappropriate in terms of the violence that we encounter in the world.
Mm. I know you have, in your writing about nuclear weapons, I think that the thing that you have said is that they're dangerous because they have such a seductive power, and it makes one feel that that one or a nation has ultimate power. Even setting those aside, is there a danger in feeling that you or your nation is this muscular colossus that stands astride the world, and that essentially you can go anywhere and do anything?
Yes, I mean, the two are related. There's a terrible danger of superpower syndrome, which is nothing less than the illusion of controlling history. Of course, one can't control history, but that's the kind of psychological mindset that we've had in relation to superpower syndrome. We haven't completely overcome it either. And nuclear weapons are crucial to this, and they are seductive. There is the condition and dreadful or grotesque spiritual disease of nuclearism, as I call it, which is an embrace of the weapons as a source of ultimate power and ultimate technology, a kind of susceptibility to an attraction to that ultimate power and wanting to share in that ultimate power. So superpower syndrome, as I define it, was largely based on nuclear dominance or nuclear hegemony, and that has to, for I think a more stable world, that has to give way to a constant effort to reduce nuclear weapons close to non-existence, and to develop a more egalitarian or equal relationship with other countries in the world. Only then can one step out of the superpower syndrome, and that means stepping out of nuclearism in this way of making the weapons false gods.
Mm. We have another caller here to talk with, someone on our line number one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My name is Dutch, and I've been listening with interest. It's interesting when nuclear power or the nuclear material used in a power plant is equated to nuclear weapons with a simple statement, they're the same stuff. Well, of course they are in a way, because they're composed of the same element. But no nuclear power plant ever has exploded as a nuclear weapon. Is that true?
I don't find that a source of great solace. It's true that...
I'm just asking if it's true.
No, what I mean, it's true that Fukushima didn't explode the way a nuclear weapon does, but when I say it's the same stuff, I mean that to be a simple equation of the technology from which they derive. And although Fukushima didn't explode like a nuclear weapon, it did undergo a considerable meltdown with release of radiation in precisely the way that can occur with and did occur with atomic weapons.
No,
so
that's
now,
not
so,
correct.
So that there is the same kind of fear and terror of what I call invisible contamination. When I studied Hiroshima survivors, they described their feelings and fear, deep fear of invisible contamination from the effects of nuclear weapons, so that even those who seemed unharmed externally might be subjected to the effects of radiation over time.
I would certainly agree with that. I think your analysis as a psychologist is spot on. However, the radiation that was released, even in Chernobyl, which was a disastrous event, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, that radiation is not the same as the radiation, either in magnitude or species, that would be released.
Well, if you're making the point that nuclear power is not as bad as nuclear weapons, I completely agree with you. Nuclear weapons, you know, when I've been in the anti-nuclear movement, nuclear weapons have been our focus, especially in the doctors' movement.
And I agree with
not,
you.
Not nuclear power, but I can't let you off the hook and simply see the beneficence of nuclear power because it doesn't explode like nuclear weapons, because it still releases radiation. And I think nuclear power is still part of the most dangerous of all human technologies, and therefore is too unsafe for us to use. That's my strong conviction.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, just because I'd rather not get into a long exchange here about nuclear power, and particularly because we only have about 5-6 minutes, and there is another subject that I want to get into, and I also have had an email from someone who would really like to have you talk about thought reform, as I have mentioned it a couple of times, and someone has written and said, well, they would really like to know what that means and how that applies to recent politics in the United States, and I'm sure that you will have something to say about that.
Yes, thought reform is an actual process employed by the Chinese communists, which consists of first a kind of psychological breakdown, and then with considerable confession, extraction, criticism and self-criticism, and then all these used in the service of what they call re-education. It's an attempt at a coercive form of changing people. I'm happy to say that it's not foolproof. It doesn't always work, but it could lay down the principles of control that people had to learn in the early days of Chinese communism. At the time that I studied it, it had enormous power, all the more so because many of the Chinese communist leaders were seen as heroes in winning the revolution against all odds. Now it's a very different story when it's seen as purely coercive, as it always has been, with the corruption in the Chinese government and the loss of belief on the part of the Chinese people in communist dogma. In terms of our own country, we don't have a systematic thought reform program, but there are disturbing things of elements of attempted thought control, perhaps especially during the Bush administration, but never entirely absent from the media. But more than that, there are documents that have now come out that make clear that in interrogation methods now employed really in connection with spilling over into torture employed by Americans at Abu Ghraib and other places in Iraq and elsewhere recently, we have directly imitated Chinese thought reform and used reports of scholars who studied thought reform as a basis for the briefing of American interrogators. That's really profoundly unethical. When I wrote about thought reform, I said throughout my book that the idea of writing about it was to confront it or confront situations of totalism, all or none behavior, so that we could avoid them ourselves, not embrace them. But there have been segments of our society and of our intelligence groups and political leaders who have wanted to embrace them and make use of them. And I have, and others have been critical of that tendency.
Hmm. Totalism, was this a term that you coined?
No, the term was coined, well, the term has been used in postmodern discourse in many different ways. It was used psychologically by Eric Erickson when he spoke of totalistic tendencies in individual people, and then he applied it to his work on Nazi behavior, limited essays he had written about Nazi behavior. And then I took up the term and used it in my work on Chinese thought reform. And through that connection in our work, we became very good friends. He was an older person and a mentor, but we became close friends and had many exchanges about totalism, whether in communist China or in the Catholic Church, in the training of Martin Luther in the 16th century. So totalism is a tendency, an all-or-none tendency, and a claim to absolute truth and virtue. It's a tendency open to everyone, and it's a grave danger in the world, and I've seen it all through my work.
And it's also it is also something that is very appealing. What is, do you think, the appeal of totalism?
The appeal of totalism lies in having all questions answered and seeing oneself as part of a movement or a tendency of absolute virtue. Without my intending it, my work became useful to young people coming out of extremist religious cults in this country. They picked up on a chapter in my book on thought reform in which I discuss the general characteristics of ideological totalism. And I came to interview a number of them, and they could tell me about how wonderful it felt to have all questions answered by an omniscient guru and to be part of a movement that they understood to be absolutely virtuous. So those are the appeals of totalism, but of course there couldn't be anything more dangerous.
Certainly dangerous, because it allows you to look at people with whom you disagree and say, not only is that person wrong, they're also evil.
Exactly. They're evil because they haven't seen our truth.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we see some of this attitude surfacing in American political life. And when we ask why agreements can't be made with certain people, it has to do with a totalistic perspective which allows no opening for dialogue. And that's hard to cope with and very dangerous to any nation and to the world.
Yeah. We're coming to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. I guess I find myself wondering, you know, you, in your work, you have worked with people who have lived through major traumatic events. Most people are fortunate in the sense that they don't, and yet it seems that life today is characterized by maybe not momentous traumatic events, but by a sort of a low level of anxiety that never quite goes away. It's kind of like a toothache. And I wonder if you have any counsel for people who feel that would describe their life or life in America now.
Well, I think there's virtue in getting underneath the toothache, in seeing what kind of infection resulting in the toothache. And my work has been predicated on the value of confronting extreme behavior of all kinds, as I say, looking into the abyss in order to see beyond it, maybe excavating the infection in order to get rid of the continual toothache. But, of course, it's not just internal in one's body. It has to do with the larger national situation, and that's where the historical dimension comes in. Mm. So we have to be activists in countering toothaches, not just victims of them.
Are there, you've done so many things and have written in many different areas, are there things that you feel you still want to do?
Well, yes, I do have things I still want to do, and I'm beginning to think about my next project, perhaps having to do with various psychological meanings of survivors that cause war to beget more war, and how that cycle might be interrupted. Hmm. That's just a glimpse of what I'm beginning to think about, but that's something more that I would like to do.
Well, I would certainly suggest to people who are listening, if they would like to learn more about Robert J. Lifton, about his life, about the things that interest him, you should look at his memoir, which has just fairly recently been published. The title of his book is Witness to an Extreme Century. It is published by the Free Press. Our guest is a lecturer in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and is also a distinguished professor emeritus at the City University of New York. And Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation. And that's where the historical dimension comes in. Mm. So we have to be activists in countering toothaches, not just victims of them.
Are there, you've done so many things and have written in many different areas, are there things that you feel you still want to do?
Well, yes, I do have things I still want to do, and I'm beginning to think about my next project, perhaps having to do with various psychological meanings of survivors that cause war to beget more war, and how that cycle might be interrupted. Hmm. That's just a glimpse of what I'm beginning to think about, but that's something more that I would like to do.
Well, I would certainly suggest to people who are listening, if they would like to learn more about Robert J. Lifton, about his life, about the things that interest him, you should look at his memoir, which has just fairly recently been published. The title of his book is Witness to an Extreme Century. It is published by the Free Press. Our guest is a lecturer in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and is also a distinguished professor emeritus at the City University of New York. And Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
WILL programs are made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, September 1st through 5th at Allerton Park. More information is available at www.allertonmusicbarn.com.
Just a reminder that we're online at will.illinois.edu. That's a way that you can listen. You can listen anytime. We're here streaming live. We also have archives of past programs. You'd like to go back and listen to some past Focus show, for example, that you might have missed. You can do that. You also can check the schedule and find out what will be coming up on the program. It's all at will.illinois.edu. And again, just a reminder that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about prostate cancer. And our guest will be Dr. Philippa Cheatham, board-certified urological surgeon at Columbia University Medical Center. And then in hour two, we'll talk with William Adler about his book, The Man Who Never Died, The Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up in the way of news, sports, weather, features, all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. The September wheat contract is down 14.5 at 859.5. December 884.25, down 14.75. September wheat in Chicago, 745, down 12.25. The December contract down 10 at 785. September corn, 752, down 4 1/4. December, 764 1/4, down 5 3/4. March, 776, down 5 3/4. The May contract, 780 1/2, down 5 1/4. September soybeans, 1443, up 5. November, 1450 3/4, up 3 3/4. January, 1459 3/4, up 3 3/4. March, 1460 3/4, up 3 3/4. September meal, 379.20, no change there. September oil, 5808, up 8. August live cattle, 113.80, up 30. And October live cattle unchanged at 114.60. September feeder cattle, no number to give you there. October, 1 for 30.